working here to know how things work there. You're listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. Hello and welcome back for another conversation here on Western Worlds, an AFM original show heard right here on astronomy.fm. My name is Raymond Francis, and I'm coming to you this week, as every week, from the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration at Western University in London, Ontario, Canada. The more we studied the diverse bodies in the solar system, from planets to asteroids to icy moons, the more we find that their surfaces are shaped by sometimes surprising processes. Rocks and minerals form differently under an exotic atmosphere, and the way they weather in the cold and vacuum of space will differ from how they might do so on Earth. But chemistry and physics work the same everywhere, so we can study those environments by looking for similar and analogous environments here on Earth, and this can help us confirm our models and prepare for missions to investigate these processes in situ. Dr. Ed Cludis works on those kinds of flight missions, specializing in spectroscopy of planetary surfaces. But to prepare, he conducts research in analog environments, both natural and constructed. He's a professor of geography at the University of Winnipeg and a member of the science teams for the OSIRIS-REx asteroid sample return mission and the Mars Science Laboratory rover. Western World's John Moores spoke with Dr. Cludis at the November 2012 Canadian Space Summit about studying other worlds, both in space and on our own.
Thanks for joining us today. We're here at the Canadian Space Summit in London, Ontario. And first of all, I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about your research.
Okay, well, thanks for inviting me here, John. It's been a good meeting so far. My research, well, I guess the overall, I'm involved in a lot of different projects, but the overall, I guess, theme of the research that I do is to try to understand the surface composition of planets using what we call spectroscopy, which is looking at how sunlight reflects off the surface of a planet and using that information to map the distribution of different minerals and rock types on planetary surfaces. And then from that, the longer term goal is to understand how different planetary bodies have evolved. What's their history? How did they originate? So that's all to contribute to, I guess, the grand vision of the origin and evolution of the solar system, which is kind of the standard line that we use.
Now, speaking of origins, I understand that you're involved with a mission called OSIRIS-REx.
That's right, yeah. OSIRIS-REx is a NASA mission that was picked for flight a couple of years ago now, and as part of the mission, Canada is contributing an instrument to that mission. The mission is, again, called OSIRIS-REx, which is an acronym for a lot of things, and the instrument that Canada is contributing is called the OSIRIS-REx Laser Altimeter, OLA. As part of Canada's contribution, there's also a parallel Canadian science team that is joining the larger OSIRIS-REx science team. So that's a wonderful opportunity for Canada because we will be able to work with our colleagues in the U.S. We'll be sharing data and sharing results. And then at the end of the mission, well, the mission is designed to bring back a sample of an asteroid. So in exchange for Canada contributing a portion of the spacecraft, this one instrument, we will have access to a portion of the sample that will be brought back to Earth. So it's a wonderful opportunity for Canada to, you know, for a relatively small contribution to kind of play a big role, to be an essential part of an asteroid sample return.
Now, this is a mission that's still a little bit off in the future. We're talking 2016 for launch, 2018, 2019. Before you get there, and then 2023 before it comes back.
That's right. Yes. It's, you know, like I said, it was selected for flight about 2 years ago now, I guess. There's always a certain lead time involved, but we're working hard towards a 2016 launch, about a two-year cruise phase, more or less, to get to the asteroid. We spend about a year and a half around the asteroid, and we use that time when we're in orbit around the asteroid to map it in exquisite detail. We want to find landing sites or sampling sites where we can touch down, scoop scoop up a piece of the asteroid and bring it back to Earth. So we're going to take our time looking at the asteroid and finding the best spot, which is a combination of both scientific interest and obviously spacecraft safety. So the touchdown, the sample return, or the sample collection, I guess, would be around 2019, 2020, and then about a 2 or 3 year cruise back to Earth. So the nominal timeline right now is a 2023 return to Earth.
That makes a lot of sense to be able to characterize and understand the asteroid as well as you can before you go into actually select that sample.
That's right. Yeah, we know, we have, you know, a little bit of Earth-based data about the asteroid. So we know things like its size, its approximate shape. We know from looking at it from Earth that it's an incredibly dark object. And so we kind of compare what it is to, like, candle soot. We're talking something that's incredibly dark. So we're trying to understand it before we send the mission. Before we send OSIRIS-REx to the asteroid, we're trying to understand as much as we can about the asteroid before we get there. And part of that is so that we can determine whether we're smart enough to determine the composition of an asteroid before we actually get there. So we want to understand as much as we can about this object before we get there, and that will just make the whole planning process that much easier.
It's an interesting thing to point out that right now it's not just technology development. There is actually science being done, and some of that science is going to be observational, and some of that science is in the lab, is it not?
That's right. Yeah. I mean, these kind of missions are, you know, a good mission, if you want to call it that, is a combination of science and technology development. So the spacecraft itself has a lot of new technology on it. So for purposes of the mission, yes, we're trying out some new technologies. We're also trying to do new and different science. And sample return is really, you know, bringing back a chunk of an asteroid is not something that NASA and CSA have really done before. So there's a nice balance between science and technology on this mission, I think.
Now, you mentioned earlier on, this is one of those cases where you get to work with our American friends, as we like to say. And you're one of those researchers in this country who has really gotten a lot of chances over the year to do many different missions. And you're even on MSL, for instance, just to name another one.
Right.
So how have you been able to get this kind of success, this sort of cross-border international context?
Boy, that's a good question. I think, you know, I do work a lot with my colleagues in the U.S., and it's a great experience. I would probably trace it back to when I did my master's degree. It was in the U.S. at the University of Hawaii. And so a lot of my fellow students that were there at the time have, you know, moved up the ranks of planetary science in the U.S. I've stayed in touch with them. And, you know, we've collaborated very well over the years. Here in Canada, there's not a lot of planetary research going on, you know, even on a proportional basis when you look at the fact that the U.S. has got a much larger population base. So I'm a fish in a small pond. I wouldn't even say a big fish. I'm just a fish in a really kind of sparsely populated pond. And so that means that there are a lot of opportunities to collaborate with colleagues in the U.S. and elsewhere. We're Canadian, we're friendly, everybody loves us, so there's always chances to work with Europeans and Americans and other space agencies. And I've always sort of said that you know, Canada's space science budget is fairly meager compared to other jurisdictions, but we somehow managed to punch above our weight. That's the expression we often use. And so I've been really fortunate to have a lot of opportunities to collaborate with colleagues in the U.S. and overseas. And I think I would attribute a lot of that to the fact that I think in Canada we do really high quality work, and I think we're just very good and innovative at stretching the most value that we can out of the dollars that we get for research.
It's true. We are very well position so close to the U.S. and one, the other big player in the field, of course, being Europe. We're a member of ESA.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, we, you know, if you look at the history of sort of how Canada has contributed or participated in planetary exploration, you're right that we do have some kind of collaborative agreement with Europe that sort of gives us access or entree into a lot of their activities. With NASA, if you look at how we participate, our general approach has been that we will contribute an instrument to a planetary mission. So, for instance, the meteorology station on the Phoenix Mars Lander, the Alpha Proton X-ray spectrometer that we have on the current MSL mission, and there's a number like that. So we make modest contributions to planetary missions. I mean, obviously contributions that we can afford, and that's a great opportunity for us to then sort of gain access to everything that goes on with the mission. So it's been a very successful approach for us.
Now, it isn't just these planetary missions that you're involved in. You also do work sort of on the technical side with analog missions as well, and sort of figuring out what kinds of tools and techniques we will need in the future.
That's right, yeah. You know, Canada, we've had a long history here in Canada of doing what are called analog missions or looking at analog sites. And briefly, what an analog site is, it's some area, some place in the country that has some attributes that are useful for understanding another planetary environment. A classic example of that is the Haughton crater up on Devon Island in northern Canada. That's an old, big old impact crater. And when you think about the climate up on Devon Island, it's cold and it's dry, so your first thought is very Mars-like environment. And that's an area that that Canada has been working in for a number of years. And we look at it for its geological scientific value. It's been a great test bed for looking at technologies and techniques for current and future exploration of Mars. And so in Canada, you know, big country, very diverse geography, there are a lot of analog sites across the country that we can look at and work at that have some relevance to other planetary bodies. And so, you know, that's a role that we have. I think we're world leaders in this idea of using analog environments to advance planetary exploration. We've been very good at that. And again, I think it's because we're fortunate that we live in a country of such diverse geology and climate.
It's true. And it's amazing you mentioned the diversity, just the kinds of environments that are out there. We've got places like Pavilion Lake
yep.
that are used as analog for some of the oceans that may exist on the icy moons.
And right.
You've got Devon Island, which is more of a Mars type of analog.
Yeah. Yeah, there's even, you know, Baffin Island, I believe Ellesmere Island, there's been some work done there where you have sulfur deposits on glacial ice, which, you know, is a potential analog again for some of the icy moons where we see frozen, you know, water ice on the surface, but we also have evidence of sulfur. So to understand how that kind of weird surface composition came about, we could probably learn something from that by looking at very bizarre sulfur ice deposits on Ellesmere Island as well.
That's true, and as I was mentioned today, you've got those two craters, the only two on the face of the planet, which have that anorthosite target material.
Yep.
So great analogs for the moon.
Mm-hmm.
So getting back to the lab work, perhaps, for a minute, that's also kind of an analog in a way, but you also work on materials from other bodies as well, do you not?
That's right, yeah. I mean, one of the things that we do in our facility at University of Winnipeg is we supplement the analog sites that we have with, I guess you can call it planet in a box, right? So we'll have a box, like a sealed container, that we can simulate a lot of different surface conditions that you don't find here on Earth, planetary environments. So, for instance, we've got what we call the Mars box, where it's the size of like a two-drawer filing cabinet on its size, and there we can reproduce the Mars atmospheric composition and pressure, and we can irradiate anything in that box with ultraviolet light to simulate the UV environment on Mars. We can cool samples down, so we can do a really good simulation of a Mars environment. And so as an example of what we would use that for, you know, we want to understand, and are minerals that contain water stable on the surface of Mars? We think we've detected a number of minerals from orbit and from the rovers that look like clay minerals, which are really just minerals that contain water. And so to really understand whether those are viable on Mars, we take a bunch of those minerals, we put them in the Mars box, we expose them to the sort of the total Mars environment, and we monitor them to see whether they're stable or do they lose the water and change to something else. So that's the kind of work that we do that, you know, helps us validate the information that we're getting back from orbiters and rovers for Mars.
It's an important piece of context because sometimes on a planetary mission you'll make a measurement and you won't know exactly what it means. It'll be a question mark, and that rover may not or that spacecraft may not have the capabilities to fully analyze it the way you do in the lab.
That's right. You know, that's again where, you know, analog areas on the Earth and environment chambers in a laboratory really come in handy. You know, you can always go back, or you can go into your laboratory or go back to data that you've collected from an analog environment and say, okay, this is what I'm seeing, say, from the Mars Science Laboratory. Okay, let's see if what we think we're seeing on the surface makes sense with what we've seen at analog sites, or let's hop into the lab, let's crank up the Mars box and see what happens when we expose something to Mars surface conditions. Is it consistent with what we might be seeing from the rovers?
It's true. And on the flip side of that, you can find an interesting process that you'd like to investigate on another and then bring instruments in to see which one will actually give you the answer.
Yeah, I'll give you, you know, as an example of that, we just finished running, it was a Canadian Space Agency sponsored project called the Mars Methane Analog Mission. And what we did there was the Canadian Space Agency has been funding the construction of a number of planetary rovers, planetary-type rovers, as well as a number of scientific instruments that can be used on these rovers. And so our Mars Methane Analog Mission was designed to, let's take a rover into an environment where methane is being produced on the Earth and could be being produced on Mars, because we picked an area where the geology of our analog site is similar to an area on Mars where we think we see enhanced methane in the atmosphere. And so this analog mission allows us to test a rover with a suite of instruments, and the scientific goal is to detect methane and determine what its source is. Right, so we set up the mission. We ran our first deployment of the rover in 2011, and we thought, here's how we're going to approach the mission. We are going to use we have a methane detector on the rover, so we're going to use that. We're going to drop it down in our landing zone in this particular environment. We're going to sniff the atmosphere. We're going to start roving around. When we start getting picking up higher methane, we're going to start moving towards that methane source. So we're going to sniff around like a hunting dog and eventually sniff and track our way to the source of the methane. That was the plan. And what we found, which was, it was unexpected, or we wouldn't have done it this way, is that when methane comes out of the ground, it seeps out of the ground on the Earth, it's much lighter than the surrounding atmosphere, and so it pretty much goes straight up. So what we found is that where we have a source of methane, if you're even 1 meter away, you don't detect it, because that methane is just basically going straight vertically into the atmosphere. And so for a search strategy on Mars, using a methane sniffer to try to find a source is not a good way to go. So this allows us to test, you know, a possible search strategy at a terrestrial environment before we even go to Mars. You know, that can save you a lot of grief down the road. So that's another benefit of analog environments, is that you get to test ideas and hypotheses and pretend missions before you invest the hundreds of millions of dollars on a real mission. So they really, you know, it's a very cost-effective way of just kind of validating hypotheses and testing instruments and all that good stuff that gives you greater confidence in an eventual real mission.
This is another way you get a little bit more bang for the buck. Yeah. You actually go to spend the big dollars to go out and explore.
That's right. You know, we just, every time we find as we go on with using these analog environments, that the benefits just sort of seem to keep expanding. You know, it's like, my God, when I first got into this, I thought, yeah, analog environments, maybe there's some cool rocks there and that's kind of it. But now that I've been working at these analog environments for half a dozen years and, you know, have been involved in a number of missions and analog missions, I'm really, really starting to see the huge benefits that you can get from working at these analog environments.
Well, let me ask you one last question here.
All right.
So I noticed that you're wearing an iron ring on your finger there. Uh-huh. And for those of our listeners who are not Canadians, if you're ever in this country, that's a sure sign that you've met someone who's done an engineering undergrad. So how is it that you got into the space science business from there?
Okay. So look for an iron ring that's faceted on the pinky of a Canadian. And if you see that, you're talking, more than likely talking to an engineer. Okay, so how I got into the planetary biz. As a kid, I was always interested in shiny rocks and minerals, like a lot of kids. And so, you know, I had a really pathetic rock collection. And then after high school, I thought, you know, I do like geology, but there was a practical streak in me. So I thought, I'm going to pursue a degree in geological engineering. And so that way I got a little bit of geology and a lot of engineering. So that was my practical degree. And then about in my third year of undergraduate at University of Toronto, I took as an elective a course in planetary geology. I thought, okay, why not? You know, I need to fill up my curriculum or my calendar. So I took this course, and it was taught by a professor named Dave Strangway, who was doing planetary science from back in the days of Apollo. And his class was just so cool. I got totally hooked on that. And, you know, by this time I'm in my third year of my engineering degree, so okay, I will finish it off. But he really put the bug in me about doing planetary. So I finished off my engineering degree, went to work in industry for a couple of years, but I always had that thing in my mind that I want to go do planetary geology. So my thought process was, okay, I've got my undergraduate degree in engineering, that's my practical degree. Now I'm going to go for planetary geology, and that's going to be my fun degree. So I enjoyed it so much, I, you know, pursued it into a PhD in planetary geology, and, you know, here we are sort of 20 years later.
Well, thank you very much for talking to us today, and good luck with the science research.
Thank you, John. Been my pleasure.
You're listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. Let's go to the discussion.
So we just heard from Ed Clutis, who's got some fabulous opportunities to work with real flying space missions. He's involved with MSL, but also with the OSIRIS-REx asteroid sample return mission, which is coming up in a few years. And that's really great. I mean, talk about a chance to work in some exciting exploration of the solar system.
Yeah, and as someone, we're smack dab in the middle of the prairies, and, you know, people think it's the middle of nowhere, but here he is involved in all these space missions and stuff like that. And I found it interesting when he was talking about how involved he got in all these space missions. And it was interesting when he noted he really got involved from Canada's perspective because there really was no one else. And so he just kind of took up the reins, and here he is now involved in all these fantastic missions. And he's a really integral part of creating some of these instruments and guiding the scientific goals of these missions.
I think what I really loved about his interview was the fact that A, he's an engineer, and then he got into this field by taking a course. I mean, he had a love for rocks, but he took this elective course just to fill up his elective course list, and he fell in love with it and came back to this after a few years working in the industry. So people don't always take the straight path.
Right.
And now, after so many years, he's here working on so many different missions, having the Canadian collaborations with the missions on other planets and in the solar system. And I really love the idea of how, as you said, bringing, you know, no one being in Canada doing this planetary science part, and then him coming in and taking over and trying to get this collaboration going. And I think it was really interesting.
Mm-hmm. So OSIRIS-REx, what is it launching in 2016?
That's the schedule.
Okay, so a couple of years from now.
And it'll take several years to reach the asteroid, do its work, and bring back.
Which is really interesting, right? Because it's a near-Earth asteroid. So when people hear near-Earth, you think, oh, okay, it's going to take a couple months to get there, and then you'll be back. But no, it launches 2016, and it will be back 2023 is the hope, right?
Yeah.
But that's with, I think it's 505 days of orbiting around it and taking, you know, all these measurements and stuff. So.
And yeah, a lot of that's driven by, you know, it might be supposedly near-Earth, but that means that its orbit is so laid out that there are easy trajectories to get to it.
Right.
And those trajectories still take a finite amount of time, and the solar system is pretty big, so mm-hmm. even the relatively near-Earth objects are a long way out. You have to spend that time at the asteroid. You have to map it. You have to characterize it. You have to understand its shape and its rotation and all of these things so that you can approach it and try to take a sample, and so that you can take a sample from an interesting place.
Right.
It's for science, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I guess if you can only have two or three pieces of the asteroid, you better have the best two or three.
Yeah, because they can only get about up to 2 kilograms or something.
Something like that. I think they have 3 shots at it.
Okay.
And so at the most, they'll get 3 samples of some uncertain size, depending on exactly the mechanical properties of the material. But they're not bringing back 100 kilograms.
No, yeah. It's just a couple kilograms max. And so this asteroid was chosen because it's considered a pristine older body, right? It's a carbonaceous asteroid, so it should... you know, in theory, have some of the oldest materials that were created very early on in the solar system, which is, I assume, why it was chosen. Because, of course, we want to study those building blocks of our solar system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so, you know, they still don't really understand exactly what that material is. They have their guesses based on distance spectroscopy and observation. But as you said, it's a really dark object, so it doesn't reflect a lot of light.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all in reflected sunlight that we're studying this, right? So they still have a lot of work to do to characterize what that object is.
The nice thing about asteroids is that we do have theoretically sample returns, right? Because we have meteorites that we've found. So they tend to, you know, they can match the spectra, for example, of the carbonaceous type meteorites that have been found on Earth, such as the Tigish Lake one that was found here in Canada, which is very early pristine type meteorite. And so I think they can try to at least match the spectra. So at least we have something to go on.
That's right.
Right.
And that's some of the spectroscopy work that Clutis does,
mm-hmm.
is to try and work with these samples that we have in the form of meteorite falls in his environment simulators and his spectroscopic labs.
I think it's very important to know different, like, say, everything comes in different flavors. So even though we have meteorites, we would still like a lot of samples from different kinds of asteroids to understand, especially if we are looking in understanding if an asteroid is going to hit Earth, and if you're planning to, let's say, deflect it or understand its orbit and trying to either to deflect it or to break it apart, or a lot of ideas are going around on how you would do it, but it would be very important to understand the material that's made of to actually do those kind of things. So I think such sample returns are really important in understanding these kind of mechanisms.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, if we were going to develop a mission for planetary defense against asteroids, which are coming sooner or later, right, then these kinds of the ability to send a spacecraft to an asteroid and work very closely around it and do very fine and dexterous mechanical and system operations near the asteroid is the kind of thing that might be very important to demonstrate before trying to do an asteroid defense or an asteroid deflection project. But it's good that we're kind of retiring some of these risks a little bit. It's a long way to go yet, though.
Yeah, it's still the first. This mission back by, 2023? It's still a long way to go before we actually go to many of these asteroids and start classifying and finding our path towards deflecting these kinds of asteroids.
And of course, there are also people who have ideas about, rather than deflection, about exploitation. Characterize those asteroids and use them to extract useful materials, be it water or metals. And you would have to be able to do even more than OSIRIS-REx can do to try and make use of those materials.
And you would probably need to do it more frequently, have more sample back, obviously have more material back rather than just a couple of kilograms of stuff. So obviously we need an improvement in technology and to do that, to understand, and also to understand these kinds of asteroids before we actually go to step on them.
And another interesting aspect of the work he talked about is the use of terrestrial analogs. Right? There are places on the Earth where we can see conditions that are in some way analogous to what we find on other planets, on other planetary bodies, and we can use them as environments to test certain things, to study them. I like the methane project. We expect that there may be some small amount of methane on Mars, and we're still trying to characterize how and why and in what way it is there. Why not go to a place where there's methane seeps on Earth and test out instrument techniques and find out that some of them don't work and that you have to have a different strategy?
I know that he talked about the analog sites, but I also liked how he talked about his Mars box and really creating a laboratory, right, where you can study similar things. So how he talked about the Martian atmosphere, how you can simulate it in the lab and not have to go find somewhere that is similar to it, because of course we don't have places on Earth that are going to be exactly similar to what we're going to be finding on Mars.
So if you don't have one, you can make an analog site.
Yeah.
I mean, there are the space agencies and the space technology companies of the world have some facilities for simulating the space environment. Some of them very impressive. You can put whole satellites into space simulators. But a Mars simulator is different because you have to put the right atmosphere and at the right pressure and temperatures as well. And as much as we know about geochemistry, we know that you expose minerals to that environment and that they'll evolve and do things a little differently than they might here on Earth with oxygen and things. So yeah, you can put them in these tests, and that's a cool facility. I'm not sure how many other places there are that have that capability. In any case, it's a good example of a variety of techniques, combining science and engineering to explore different aspects of planetary science, both in flight missions and analogs and on the ground, advancing technology and science together. And I think it's a really good example of diverse approaches that are starting to win out for us.
That's our show for this week. Western Worlds is a co-production of the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration and Astronomy.fm. Western Worlds was created by John Moores. This episode was produced by Parshati Patel and Michael Forster and featured an interview by co-host John Moores. Our roundtable discussion featured co-hosts Raymond Francis, Alyssa Gilbert, and Parshati Patel. Our editors were Zengi Hu and Parshati Patel, and I'm Raymond Francis. Our theme music is Heliosheath by Sean Kim. You can continue the conversation online and listen to past episodes or learn more about Western Worlds by visiting our website, cpsx.uwo.ca/westernworlds. You can also email us at westernworlds@uwo.ca. On Twitter, we are @WWAFM, and on Facebook, we are facebook.com/westernworlds. On behalf of everyone here at Western Worlds, I'd like to thank you for joining us tonight. I hope you can find world enough and time to join us again next week right here on astronomy.fm.